Revelation chapter 20, we saw last time. It's one of the great chapters really in the New Testament. It has three great parts to it. In chapter 20, verses 1 to 6, we have this millennial reign of Christ. And then we have described a final rebellion from Satan. And then we have in verses 11 through 15, the great white throne judgment or the final judgment. Before we go on, though, and talk about the release of Satan and the great white throne judgment, I thought I might just circle back for a moment and say a couple things about the millennium. There's so much more we can say about it, about this millennial reign of Christ. But we talked a little bit about church history last time and how the early church for the first 150 years were kiliasts. And that word comes from the Greek word for a thousand. So they believed in a literal thousand-year reign of Christ. Later on, when Latin became the dominant language and it became the word millennium, which means also a thousand years. But I wanted to circle back and mention one thing, because the real development of amillennialism happened under a man named Tychonius, and then by Augustine, who wrote extensively about the thousand years of Revelation, and in Revelation chapter 20. But Augustine, in his book, The City of God, states why he left his position. He had been a kiliast. He had believed in a literal thousand-year reign of Christ on the earth, but he left that position. And it was really under Augustine that amillennialism really was developed, and then it became the dominant view of the church really for centuries. Because when you think about it, most people in that day couldn't read. So kind of whatever you were told is what you believed. Premillennialism began to really mushroom in the 16th and 17th centuries when the printing press came along and people began to get their own Bibles. People began to read the Bible for themselves, and they'd read these promises in the Old Testament that God had for Israel, and they would wonder, well, when are these things going to be fulfilled? And so there was a rebirth at that time of premillennialism. But amillennialism dominated the church from the time of Augustine really to through the time of the Reformers. But in City of God, Augustine tells why he left kiliasm. He said this: "But since they say that those who are to rise again will enjoy a holiday of the most immoderate carnal feasts, in which food and drink will be so plentiful that not only will they observe no limits of moderation, but will also exceed all bounds, even of incredulity, all this can be believed only by the carnally minded." See, what he's saying here is this idea of a literal reign on the earth and feasting and all of that, only a carnally minded person would believe that. He says, "Those who are spiritually minded call those who believe these things in Greek kiliasts." And we may in Latin translate the term as millenarians. So he's kind of following this idea that a literal interpretation is kind of a carnally minded. In fact, one writer said this in a book called The Millennial Hope of the Early Church. He's talking about Origen, who really developed the idea of kind of allegorical interpretation. He said, "For Origen, the kiliasts were visionaries, deluded fools, and what was worse, literalists." So if you're a kiliast and you believed in a literal thousand year, you were a visionary, a deluded fool, and the worst thing could be said about you is you were a literalist. But again, as we talked about last time, I think if we take this passage here in Revelation chapter 20, literally, the literal normal meaning of the language, that's exactly where we end up. So anyway, I thought I'd circle back and mention that, because that's where amillennialism came from. That's how kiliasm was kind of replaced. But later on in church history, premillennialism became the dominant view again. Well, chapter 20, verses 1 to 6, is all about this thousand-year reign of Christ. But as I said last time when we left off, there's a strange twist to the story. Because what you would expect now is Jesus is ruling and reigning for 1,000 years, and we're just going to go now on into eternity. It's all going to be wonderful now. He's taken the kingdom. The 1,000-year reign of Jesus, I call the front porch of eternity, where it's phase one of the eternal kingdom. The 1,000-year reign of Christ is not the only kingdom. You know, the kingdom of God is eternal. So people often say, well, how do you hold to it only being 1,000 years if it's eternal? It's only the first phase. It's phase one. It's the front porch of the eternal kingdom of God. But it's when God comes, when Christ comes and takes back this earth and fulfills the promises for this earth that God had made to the first Adam. But the first Adam failed, and the last Adam is going to come and fulfill what God had promised for this earth. And so in chapter 20, verses 1 to 6, Jesus is ruling and reigning. He has received the inheritance. That scroll that he begins to open in chapter 5 is ultimately and finally realized, and he takes and rules over the kingdoms of the earth. But then in chapter 20, verse 7, when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison. Now, I remember a guy years ago, I heard about a man that asked Lewis Sperry Chafer, who founded Dallas Seminary. He said, why in the world is God going to release Satan out of the abyss after the 1,000 years? And Chafer's response was, if you can tell him why God let him go the first time, I'll tell you why he let him go the second time. A lot of mystery to the whole idea just of evil, of why God allowed a being like Satan to exist. But while we may not understand the purposes of God completely, God is going to let Satan go at the end of the 1,000 years. So this 1,000 years will be a time when Satan is bound. I call this here the second coming of Satan. This is Satan's last stand. And he will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand on the seashore. Now again, remember, this is a non-specific statement of a large number, which goes against the idea that the 1,000 years is symbolic. He uses 1,000 years literally when he wants to just say something is a large number. He says like the sand on the seashore. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. So the beloved city here would be the city of Jerusalem. And fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are also. And they'll be tormented day and night forever and ever. The second coming of Satan, he's going to come out of the abyss. And when he comes out of the abyss, he's going to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, and gather them for a war. And the number of them is going to be like the sand on the seashore. Now, you would think with Jesus Christ having ruled and reigned in the midst of the world for 1,000 years that every person would yield to him. Now remember, when the 1,000 years starts, when Jesus returns to the earth at his second coming, he's going to judge those who are on the earth, and those who are unbelievers are going to be sent away into judgment, but the believers then are going to go into the millennial kingdom. So at the beginning of the millennial reign of Christ, everyone will be a believer in the Lord. They'll all be believers. You have to be a believer to enter the kingdom. But over 1,000 years, there's going to be children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and on of descendants. And many of them will not yield in their hearts to Jesus Christ. Now, there won't be outward rebellion on the earth during this time because Jesus won't stand for it. He's going to rule the nations with a rod of iron. But when Satan is released, he's going to go out and find enough rebels on the earth that it's like the sand on the seashore. And he calls it here Gog and Magog. Now, we need to talk about that because the only other reference to Gog and Magog in the scriptures is back in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Ezekiel 38, in Ezekiel 38, Gog is a person and Magog is a place. But here you notice they aren't distinguished from one another. It's just Gog and Magog. And because of that, I would say that this is used here symbolically. And I think we have license to take it symbolically because it's just used together, whereas back in Ezekiel 38, they're separate. Gog's a person, Magog's a place. So he's using it here in kind of a symbolic way. Now you say, well, how is he using Gog and Magog? Remember back in Ezekiel 38 and 39 describes an invasion of Israel in the end times by a great coalition of nations. And God is going to come in supernaturally and destroy them with fire and brimstone from heaven. So what I think John is doing here in saying Gog and Magog is it's kind of like saying the word Waterloo. You know, someone met their Waterloo. You're not saying it's literally Waterloo, but it's a shorthand way of saying they were totally defeated. Or we could say Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is like World War I, and Gog and Magog here is kind of like World War II. So he's kind of saying it's Gog and it's Magog. It's another Gog and Magog. We know they're different because in Ezekiel 38, it's specific nations that are mentioned, whereas here it's all the nations. In Ezekiel 38, it's before the millennium because remember Ezekiel 40 to 48 describe a great millennial temple that's never existed. Ezekiel 38 and 39 are before the millennium. Here, this Gog and Magog is at the end of the millennium. So the timing's different. Also, in the Gog and Magog, back in Ezekiel 38, they burned the weapons for 7 years after the battle. And that's not consistent here with this happening at the end of the millennium. So these are two different things, but Gog and Magog here is just a shorthand way. He's just basically saying, look, this is going to be Gog and Magog all over again. He's saying, you remember Gog and Magog, where all those nations came against Israel and God wiped them out? It's going to be Gog and Magog all over again. That's what he's saying here. I think he's using it in that way. Because again, it says, these nations come up against the camp of the saints in the beloved city, which is Jerusalem. So they're attacking the Jews. And fire came down from heaven and devoured them. One of the things that is interesting here is, why is God, as I said earlier, going to allow this final revolt? Let me just mention a few things here, and I'm not sure we can be certain of this, but let me say why, a few theological reasons why God may permit Satan to be released. One of them is to show the failure of man in a perfect environment. You eliminate Satan for 1,000 years, and man is still a sinner. You think in the Garden of Eden, Satan was there, but man had no flesh or sin nature. Throughout all of time between that period of time, we've all had a sin nature and Satan is present. During the millennium, man's going to have a sin nature, but Satan's not going to be there. So God's tested man under every circumstance under which he can be tested, and it will be proven once and for all that man is a sinner. Also, the release of Satan at the end of this time will prove the incurable wickedness of Satan. After 1,000 years in incarceration, when he comes out, Satan is still Satan. He hasn't changed. I read this years ago. A man made this statement. And to me, it's a simple statement, but a profound one. He says, after 1,000 years in the abyss, when Satan comes out, Satan's still Satan and man is still man. 1,000 years of the reign of Christ hasn't changed it. Another reason for this may be to show the need for eternal punishment. You know, it just shows how bad and incurably wicked man really is, because the idea of eternal punishment kind of boggles our mind, but it may give us some of the reason. Look, that's how bad man is. And I think another reason for this here is just to prove the need for the death of Jesus Christ. Why did God have to go to the ultimate remedy that he went to send his own son to die for man? Because man's heart is black with sin, and only the death of the Son of God could come and pay for the sin of man. So that may be some of the reasons here for this. So Satan's released here, and there's this rebellion of the nations. So we go from a worldwide kingdom of Jesus to a worldwide rebellion. Now, why are these nations going to join up with Satan? What's the source of this? What's going to move the nations to rebel? Now, I read this in one book one time. I've only read this from one person, but it stuck in my mind, and I'll just mention it to you to kind of think about. Notice when they rebel, they gather on the broad plain and they surround the camp of the saints and the beloved city. They surround the city of Jerusalem. They come against Israel. Could it be that it's anti-Semitism that moves these people once and for all to come against Israel? Remember the age-long battle we looked at between the woman Israel and Satan back in chapter 12? When Satan comes out of the abyss and he sees the situation on the earth, what's he going to see? Jesus ruling and reigning in Jerusalem as David's king, as the Davidic king. He's going to see the Jewish people in a favored position there, ruling and reigning in their land under the covenants that God promised to fulfill with them. And it could be that Satan comes out of the abyss and begins to go around to people and say, look at the favoritism those people have there. In other words, create jealousy. That's why Jesus was crucified by the leaders. They were jealous. So it could be here, and this is an amazing thought, Satan's last-ditch effort to get rid of the Jews. He's tried it ever since the time of Abraham on. So it could be a motivating factor here in this. Then the final verse here says, and the devil who deceived him stoned into the lake of fire and brimstone. Notice where the beast and the false prophet are. In other words, there's no annihilationism. After 1,000 years, the beast and the false prophet are still in the lake of fire. They weren't annihilated. They haven't ceased to exist. And so this is the end of the false trinity. And Satan, who made his entrance into human history in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1, makes his inglorious exit here. So we have four chapters in the Bible where Satan's not present. Genesis 1 and 2. Revelation 21 and 2. He's there for the other 1,185 chapters in between. but he's eliminated here. And notice it says here, they're tormented day and night forever and ever. I alluded before to the fact of the eternality of hell and the seriousness of that. A lot of people reject that today. They reject the idea of hell at all. They hold a universalism, everybody's going to make it to heaven. Or they say, well, there may be a hell, but if it is, it's not eternal. It's kind of a kinder, gentler view of the afterlife. I like this quote from John Walvoord. Dr. Walvoord says this in one of his books. There either is or is not a future of eternal punishment. Whether we agree with it or not has very little bearing on the issue. The vote against it could be unanimous, and still hell might be a reality. God did not consult us when planning his righteous judgment of the sinful human race. The ultimate question is whether the Bible, which is our only source of information about what happens after death, teaches a doctrine of eternal conscious punishment. That's the issue, isn't it? Does the Bible teach it? I like that. He says, the vote against hell could be unanimous, and yet it could still exist. A lot of people, they're trying to wish it away, but you have here clearly stated, as we do have in other places in the book of Revelation here, the reality of eternal judgment. The next thing in verse 11 that we see here, and I saw a great white throne. Notice again the "and I saw." It's just taking us sequentially through this passage here. He said, I saw a great white throne. It's a mega white throne, and him who sat upon it, and the one sitting upon it certainly is Jesus Christ. I remember in John 5:22, as Jesus says, the Father judges no one, but he's given all judgment to the Son. So Jesus is seated here on a mega white throne. And notice from whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. I think this is a little preview here of what we're going to see in chapter 21, where the universe disappears. God, who spoke the universe into existence by his word, is going to speak it out of existence. So Jesus is seated there on a great white throne, and heaven and earth flee away from him, and there's no place found for them. They disappear. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne. Books were opened, another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged from the things written in the books, according to their deeds. The sea gave up the dead in it, death and Hades gave up the dead in them, and they were judged, each one of them, according to their deeds. This is a great courtroom scene here. This is the convening of the Supreme Court of the universe. You know, it's been interesting to me in the past few decades, we've seen a lot of TV shows about that focus on the courtroom. When I was growing up, you had Perry Mason, and you had L.A. Law, and Law and Order, and the People's Court, and The Practice. And then you have all these real courtroom dramas, like the O.J. Simpson case and Casey Anthony. People are just fascinated with these things. But what we have here in this passage is the ultimate courtroom drama. It's going to occur someday in heaven in the courtroom of God when all of those who have rejected Jesus Christ are going to have their day in court. The Bible calls it here the great white throne. It's fascinating to me here. It says the dead and all the great and the small are brought before this throne. But notice the last thing they see before they come and stand before this great white throne is they see heaven and earth flee away and no place found for them. You talk about all the atheists and the blasphemers and people who reject God and don't believe he's real. They're going to stand before him someday at the great white throne, and the last thing they're going to see is the universe disappear. He's going to speak it out of existence, and then they're going to have to stand before him. This is the most sobering scene in all the Bible, and I don't think we can really get our minds around it. There are several different judgments in the Bible. I think as believers in Jesus Christ, when we're raptured to heaven, we're going to undergo or experience what's called the Bema Seat of Christ or the Judgment Seat of Christ. We'll appear before the Lord there to receive rewards for the things done in the body, whether good or bad. So every person in this age, this current age, is either going to appear as a believer at the Judgment Seat of Christ or at the end of the age, all the unbelievers are going to be resurrected here to appear before this great white throne. And you'll notice here that Exhibit A is the books. The books were opened, plural. And then Exhibit B is the book of life. It's the book of life. They look in the book of life to see if their name is written there. And of course, it's not. I mean, God is just doing this, obviously, as a as a note of decorum. They're looking for their name. Is it in the book of life? And the book of life is referred to several times here in the book of Revelation. That it's the book whose names, the elect's names have been written in it from the foundation of the world. So the book here is the book of life, but the books are probably the deeds of these lost people. And so they're going to be judged from the book of life. That is, their name's not found there, so they'll be cast into the lake of fire. But the books are opened to look at the deeds they committed on this earth to determine the degree of punishment. Just as there is degree of reward for the righteous in heaven, there will be degrees of punishment for the unrighteous in hell. Jesus says back in the book of Luke, he says, you know, some will be beaten with many stripes, some with few stripes. Jesus said it's going to be better for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than it is for Capernaum and for Chorazim and Bethsaida, because they had more light from God. So God is just, and his judgment will be meted out, and the degrees of punishment will be given to those who've rejected him. But it says the sea gave up the dead in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them. Remember again, Hades is the holding place for the souls of those who've died. Hades is kind of like the county jail, and lake of fire is like the penitentiary. So their souls have been in Hades all of this time. That's where the rich man in Luke 16, when he died, he went to Hades. So Hades gives up the souls of those who are in it. And they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. And death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. In the Bible, when it talks about death, the Bible means separation. Remember back in the Garden of Eden when God told Adam and Eve, if you eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you'll die. And when he said, you'll surely die, when they ate of it, they died spiritually. That is, they were separated from God. When a person dies physically, there's a separation that takes place. The material and the immaterial separate. The believer, their soul goes to heaven. For the unbeliever, it goes to Hades. So death in the Bible means separation. So there's physical death, there's spiritual death, which is separation from God. And the second death here is what we might call eternal separation. They're going to be separated from God. As the book of Thessalonians says, they'll be away from the glory of his majesty. What will ultimately make hell hell is separation from God. The presence of God will not be there. That's what makes hell hell. And by the way, what makes heaven heaven? God is there. Heaven is heaven because God is there. Hell is hell because God is not there. And then this verse 15 here, no more sobering verse in all the Bible. If anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he's thrown in the lake of fire. So we have here in this scene the courtroom, we have the judge, we have the defendants, the summons, we have the evidence presented against them, exhibit A, exhibit B, we have the verdict is guilty, and the sentence is a confinement to the lake of fire. This is the final culmination here of God's judgment in this world. And I'm going to read a quote here as well. I read one earlier from Dr. John Walvoord. I took my bookmark out of here, so I'm going to have to find this quote here. Hopefully you can edit this out, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Let's see. I found out I got his quote in here, and then I took my... Warren Wiersbe captures something of the drama of the final judgment at the Great White Throne. He says this, "The Great White Throne judgment will be nothing like our modern court cases. At the White Throne, there will be a judge but no jury, a prosecution but no defense, a sentence but no appeal. No one will be able to defend himself or accuse God of unrighteousness." So it's not like the human courts we have today. And old A.B. Simpson wrote a beautiful little poem years ago. He says, "What will you do with Jesus? Neutral you cannot be. Someday your heart will be asking, what will you do with me?" This is the final judgment here that the Bible speaks of here in Revelation chapter 20. Now, next time we're going to pick up, and all the rest of what we're going to talk about the next two sessions is all good news. Bad news is over. We're going to go into the new heaven, the new earth, into the eternal state. And we'll talk about what heaven is like in the future, but also what is heaven like now. There's a distinction between those two. We talk about going to heaven now. When someone dies and goes to heaven, where do they go? And then what will heaven be in the eternal state or in the future? So there are a lot of questions people have about the afterlife, and we'll pick up there in chapter 21 next time.